This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, call 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. In addition to your calls, of course, some interesting topics to talk over. Zorba?
Yes, we're going to talk about apps for your iPhone and other smartphones. Do those apps or applications actually help you get healthy?
I had no idea what apps meant.
Well, do you know what a cell phone is, Tom?
Yes. What else?
And friends, what are they for? Well, maybe they're to give you a longer life. Some interesting information that comes out of the University of Virginia and out of Australia.
That is interesting. We'll look forward to it. What about our recipe?
Stuffed lamb burgers. If you love lamb, this is a dynamite recipe. And if you haven't given lamb a try recently, now is the time to think about it. This recipe you will love.
You know I'm looking forward to this one. We have our medical myth buster coming up as well. Lots of great reasons for you to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. And Zorba, before we take our first call, I think this is kind of interesting. You know, hospitals are prevented by federal law from releasing patient information. Everybody knows that, right?
Right.
But when we're a patient in a hospital, sometimes we reveal more than we'd like about ourselves because of those stupid hospital gowns that open up in the back all the time.
Yes, the lack of designer gowns. The lack of designer
gowns. Well, now here's a professor at North Carolina State University who's been working for years to redesign the hospital gown.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Do you think this is a worthwhile thing?
Of course, Tom. Of course, Tom. I mean, I've been in the hospital, and when you walk down that hallway and you're showing your derriere, you just kind of wonder
why would it take 2 years to redo this, I wonder. Uh-huh. What's the point of having these gowns that open up in the back all the time? Is there any reason for this?
Well, the reason is supposedly you can take off the clothes suddenly when you've got to do procedures and all sorts of other things. But I think the reason behind it is simply the fact that they've been doing it for so many years and nobody can come up with a reason to get rid of them. Or maybe they just own all the gowns and they don't want to get rid of the gowns.
Well, good luck to this prof at North Carolina State University.
Good luck. Keep up the good work and maybe we won't show our derriere as we walk down the hall.
Let's get to the phones. A caller with us now in St. Charles, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help you?
Well, my situation is this. I've heard a lot of talk in the news and on your show about people who have seasonal affective disorder, where, of course, they become depressed in the fall and winter months.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually must be completely the opposite, because to me, I start getting depressed and bummed out in the spring and the summer. As most of my friends and people I work with know, on a day that starts out nice and cloudy, I'm really happy. And then, say, around 8 or 9, the sun comes out. I'm like, man, it was a beautiful day, but the sun came out and ruined it all.
Huh.
You know, I have to tell you, as somebody who lives in the upper Midwest, hearing something like that just gives me a shudder that one day, because I have a little seasonal affective disorder, I may actually be upset when I have the opposite. But what you have is actually a syndrome akin to seasonal affective disorder, and it affects a very, very small part of the population. Seasonal affective disorder, especially in the upper parts of North America and the lower parts of South America and Europe, where you really have short days and long nights, is actually a pretty common thing. It affects up to 10 to 15 to 20% of the population. But there's about 1 to 2% of the population that's affected with the opposite of seasonal affective disorder, at least the opposite of the traditional. And it's called atypical seasonal affective disorder, where long days and sunny days actually produce it. And it's a strange thing.
Nothing you can do about this?
Of course. Come on. I'm a physician.
Oh.
There's always something we can do. First of all, we can bill for it and send a bill to the insurance company. That's beneficial. No, no. I'm only kidding. But seriously, there are things you can do for it. First of all, and this would be the second thing I would go to, antidepressants actually work very well for this because they work for seasonal affective disorders of all sorts. So, for instance, usually for people with traditional SAD, you take it about the first day of fall, and then you stop around the first day of March, and they're on it for 4 to 6 months. In other words, during the dark time of the year. For people with atypical seasonal affective disorder, they do it exactly the opposite. That is a medical treatment for this. Now, here's the problem. The issue with seasonal affective disorder is we know that 20 minutes in a light box, and these light boxes, if you do light box SAD and Google that on the web, you will find out how to buy light boxes and how to make them. But there's no evidence that the light box works for people with atypical seasonal affective disorder because you're bothered by too much light. So some people theorize that basically keeping your window shades closed, making sure that your house is not too bright during the season that you're bothered might actually work. And so what I would recommend doing is basically, I don't recommend that you shut yourself in and not go outside, but I recommend that you basically keep the windows dark in the house, and essentially that might help you.
Well, you could make a dark box, right?
You could make a dark box. There we go.
It would keep the light out and stare into it for half an hour in the morning.
You see, Tom has figured out a way out of this. And not only that, but a way to make money. It's called Tom's Dark Box, and you stare into a dark box for 20 minutes a day. Maybe that'll work.
Alternatively, you could move to Wisconsin, where we don't see very much of the sun.
That is the other way. And by the way, anyone else in your family have this atypical SAD?
Actually, I don't know my family history because I'm adopted.
Okay. Yeah, because this does tend mm-hmm. to run in families. So good luck, and buy Tom's darkbox.org on the web today. We're going to put up a site, and we're going to make the big bucks.
Sounds great.
I've got it spent already. We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, what's this about the cell phone being able to help our diet?
Well, Tom, first of all, you know, mobile phones have become commonplace. I mean, we've got a Luddite here who's ready to sort of mobile phones, and people call them. And then there's a new kind of mobile phone called the smartphone. It's an iPhone. Sprint has a phone.
I've seen it because you pull it out every now and then.
Well, yeah. I've got one right here. I've got it shut off now because it all of a sudden call in the middle of the show. But these have applications, and they're basically small little computers. And there are a couple of very, very interesting applications that are helping people lose weight. And this is a big problem for people who are on the road. They're on the road, and, you know, you're in a strange city, and you want to know where you're going to eat. And then you want to know how many calories the food is. So this was a particular story that I basically pulled off the wires that looked at a variety of weight loss applications. That was one story. Weight loss applications allow you to put in the food, see how many calories there are. This is really important. What do you think the most caloric sandwich is at Subway? Guess.
I don't know the Subway diet.
The tuna sandwich is the most caloric one.
That, yeah.
And it's because of the mayo. I mean, it's got 550 calories. Tuna normally has, by itself, it doesn't have very many calories. Tuna has a good look to it. Well, it turns out it really isn't. And if you look that up on an application and you see it, you can go, hey, I'm going to Subway, because a lot of times they don't really have the calories there. So this is allowing people, when they go to a restaurant, to sit down and say, wait a minute, this has a lot in there. Maybe I shouldn't have the cheese on there. Maybe I shouldn't have the extra dressing on there. It allows you to go into a restaurant and look on the menu and put in the things on the menu and see how many calories they are.
Okay.
Well, this allows people not only not to gain weight, but to lose weight. So that's one app that is very good. So a weight loss application for your smartphone is excellent for calories. The other application, there are numerous restaurant applications. ChowHound, Yelp, there are a number of other ones that are on there. So you can specify the type of restaurant you want to go to. Perfect example was me. I was up in Green Bay. I was giving a lecture, and I was there, and I thought, you know, I don't want a brat. I know that I can go to 10,000 restaurants in Green Bay and get a brat and a beer. And so I looked on my smartphone, which happens to be an iPhone, and I put down, Asian restaurant. And lo and behold, one block away, off to the left in a corner, was a Thai restaurant. Well, I didn't know there was a Thai restaurant there. I mean, who carries a Yellow Pages with them? And so that application was very useful for me. And now I use it whenever I go on the road to find the food I'm looking for. So smartphones with a weight loss application and a restaurant application is a way to lose weight. Yeah.
You know what all of this makes me think of?
Right.
I want to have a brat.
You know what? You are incorrigible.
800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What's up?
My husband is quite athletic, plays soccer, used to play lots of sports. He's had a herniated disc in his lower back for about 2 years now.
Ooh.
And his stomach seems to be getting bloated by the month.
So the weight gain is due to his inability to exercise? Do I get that right?
He's not gaining it elsewhere. His arms are firm, his legs are firm, it's his stomach. And it always looks bloated, whether he eats anything gassy or not.
Mm-hmm. How old's your husband?
34.
Okay. What's his height? What's his weight? Do you know that?
He's probably about 5'9", 5'10".
Okay.
He weighs about 185.
185. Okay. So 5'9", 5'10", 185 is really, you know, I mean, that's a reasonable weight, like you said. I mean, he's not, you know, I can't calculate it. It's BMI in my head, but that's about right between 175 and 185. Has he gained much weight since this has happened?
He has.
He has.
But
how,
people keep rubbing his belly and telling him that's a sign of a good marriage. So.
A sign of a good marriage. A sign of a good marriage. How is your marriage? Is it a good marriage?
It is.
Well, you see, they're right. They're right. It is the sign of a good marriage. So now getting back to this, how long has it been that he's had this this disc problem? A
couple of years.
It's been a couple of years.
Uh-huh. Right.
The issue is, as we get older and we eat more and expend fewer calories and we put on weight, the space between the muscle and the skin essentially is subcutaneous space. And that's where we tend to put our fat on. His problem is he's not expending enough calories for the calories that he's taking in. So he's not going to be able to do crunches. But the reality is the crunches are secondary to the weight that he's gained. So what he's got to do is eat less food and he's got to do more aerobic exercise and lose weight. That's what he's. It's the only way it's going to work, because he's never, even if he builds up those muscles, he's 35 now, he's not 19. And,
right.
And the reality is, once you get after a certain age, you just have the fat that you put on in your gut. And so my recommendation is feed him less. Hi, honey. Guess what we're having tonight? Not as much food. And that's
right. We're going to have salad instead of steak.
That's the way to do it. I mean, that's the way to do it. Or if you're going to have steak, Tom is now, his mouth is watering.
That sounds like a great
idea to me. You know, I have to tell you, as soon as someone says steak, I can literally see him salivating. It's so difficult to sit opposite it because steak, Tom go hand in hand. But if you're going to eat something like steak, what you want to do is make it a filet. You want to make it, you want to have less. Yeah. If you're going to even get something like a T-bone, you want it to be a thin or a small T-bone.
And he loses some weight. Zorba, her marriage still stays a good marriage.
Absolutely. Believe me. They'll still rub his tummy and say, good marriage. I bet it's still there.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Our pleasure is
ours. We appreciate the call. Thank you. 800-462-7413. Caller's waiting, but a line is open now for you at 1-800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba, in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi.
Hello, guys.
How can we help?
Well, I have been for a long time a migraine sufferer and just a headache sufferer in general. And so I've spent a lot of time, as I'm sure most migraine sufferers do, trying to find all these different triggers and things that may be causing these migraines. And recently, I just decided to cut soda out of my diet completely, and my headaches have pretty much disappeared, with the exception of maybe a couple. And, I mean, I'm the type of person that I literally had at least some level of a headache almost every day.
Mm.
And now it's like I get an occasional headache, but I mean, the rest of the time I feel great.
Can I ask, were you doing the caffeinated sodas or the non-caffeinated sodas?
It was a cola, like a diet cola.
Yeah.
Caffeine, we know, is a great migraine trigger. We know that in small amounts, caffeine can actually help in migraine, but in larger amounts, caffeine and caffeine withdrawal is one of the major triggers for all sorts of headaches that you have. And I know that from personal experience. If I drink too much coffee, I will get a headache. And if I go on a camping trip where I often don't have coffee because I just have tea on a camping trip, I will get a headache for a couple of days because I'm going through caffeine withdrawal unless I taper down before I'm actually on there. You had a cola-type soda, you know, you had Coke or Pepsi, whichever one, and basically it sounds to me like you had migraines triggered by the absence of caffeine. Yeah, that's basically what it was. Mountain Dew, by the way, is the worst.
Has well, he was having caffeine. The headaches while he was drinking the caffeine.
Yeah, well, because caffeine is, you take a little more one day, you take a little less one day.
Oh, okay.
You go through ups and downs. You drink the caffeine in your body. 4 hours later, the caffeine is out of your body. You can get a rebound headache, and then you drink some more caffeine, and the headache goes away, and you get into this terrible syndrome. So I've got a recommendation for you. If you go back to a carbonated drink, make sure it is caffeine-free forever.
Okay.
That's really, really important because I think caffeine is the issue. Coffee, make it decaf. If you're going to have tea, make sure it's an herbal tea or a caffeinated tea. And if the migraines continue, are you on a beta blocker like Atenolol or Inderol, any one of the beta blockers?
Yeah, I've been subscribed Inderol, and mm-hmm. I haven't been taking it recently just to kind of trying to figure out what it is that might have been triggering it.
Right.
And that definitely helped, you know, when I was taking that. But now that I haven't been taking what we found out now, the caffeine or soda, it's like I almost feel like I don't need it.
Way to go. That's fabulous. If you can find the triggers, you can get rid of it. I want to congratulate you. That's you were a detective with your own problem. And if more people did that and were detectives, especially with headaches, they would find their triggers and then they would treat it in a natural way, which is always preferable to any kind of a drug treatment.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. You know, it was so debilitating that I felt like I had to find a solution somehow.
Well, great. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Yep. Bye-bye. Appreciate the call from Baltimore. Before we take the break, Zorba, and get to our recipe, which I'm looking forward to, let's take a quick question from the Zorba Pastor on your health inbox. This one comes to us from Stephanie in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, and it deals with sneezing. She writes, is it really true that the number of times you sneeze is genetic? I always sneeze twice, and so does our year-and-a-half-year-old son. Good thing he doesn't take after his father, who sneezes in waves of 8.
So is this genetic? I don't know if there's any evidence that sneeze. I mean, first of all, we all sneeze. Everybody sneezes.
But nobody sneezes the same number of times each time.
I don't think so. Except Stephanie and her husband. And the fact is, even then, it would be hard to prove it's genetic versus learned behavior. I just think some people sneeze and some people don't. And some families sneeze more because they have allergies. And some families sneeze less.
Our producer, Adam Friedrich, says he always sneezes in threes.
In threes. In threes. Now, my wife, Penny.
Now, isn't that interesting?
My wife, Penny, always sneezes in two. In two. How about your wife, Monica? How does she sneeze?
Who knows? In different numbers. We sneeze until you don't have to sneeze anymore. Once? 4 times? It's not a pattern, except with you
people. Maybe you're just not keeping track, Tom. Maybe you're not paying attention to your wife.
That could be.
And the number of sneezes that she makes.
Well, we can only answer your questions one at a time. Send them to us in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up and some research after a really yummy recipe.
Delicious. Delicious. Stuffed lamb burgers.
Ooh, lamb burgers. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. Right now, though, recipe time. Can you smell that?
Stuffed lamb burgers. Do you like lamb as lamb?
I
happen to like lamb. Oh, I have to tell you a little lamb story.
Yeah.
This is a number of years ago.
Mary had a little lamb.
That's very funny. But her name wasn't Mary. Her name actually was Deb. Very nice person.
Okay.
And this is when I was delivering babies a number of years ago. I delivered like 500 babies in my career. And she had no money. And she raised lambs. So she said, I'll give you a lamb.
Oh, like
you
the old days.
My baby, just like the old days.
Yeah.
So I made a mistake. I love lamb. Getting the lamb was not a mistake. The mistake was I went with my daughter, Dee Dee. She was young.
I can see where this story's going.
You got it, baby. I went to the lamb farm. We looked all around. We looked at the lambs. And I said, which lamb do you like? Oh, I like that little lamb. I said, okay. And then, okay, so here it is. Like, you know, a month later, we've got all this lamb in our freezer in the basement. So I made a wonderful, wonderful lamb stew. And we're sitting down as a family. She must have been 8 or 9, and they're all eating lamb, and she said, what is this? I said, it's lamb. And she said, oh, lamb. She said, Dad, remember that time we went to, which was a month ago, and she looked at me, and then she looked at the dish, and then she lost it. She just couldn't take it.
Crying
and other activities, in addition to crying, ruined the whole meal. Let me tell you, ruined the whole meal, and she didn't eat lamb for the next 10 years. I mean, now she's graduating medical school, and periodically, every time we go somewhere and we have lamb, she will remind me of what I did as a bad daddy.
My wife doesn't eat lamb, I think, because of how cute the lambies are.
No, maybe I brought your wife to the farm once.
Maybe.
Anyway, but I happen to like lamb.
This is stuffed lamb burgers.
Stuffed lamb burgers. Start out with 1.5 pounds of ground lamb.
A pound and a half of ground lamb.
Now, the way to get ground lamb is to go to your butcher or your grocery store and ask them to order it for you if you can't get it. Because often they actually can get it. It's just not sitting out there because it's not common. When I get ground lamb or I get something of this nature for this type of a dish, if it's from a butcher or from a butcher type store, I'll ask them to ground it twice. And the reason is it makes it finer, which is really much tastier.
Okay.
Two large garlic cloves. 1 teaspoon to 1.5 teaspoons of kosher salt. Now, be careful with the salt. If you're unsure, just use a half a teaspoon, but a teaspoon to a teaspoon and a half of kosher salt.
Okay, some salt.
That's right. 1/4 cup of crumbled feta cheese.
Oh, 1/4 cup of crumbled feta cheese.
That's right. Now, feta is goat cheese, and it has a very striking flavor. It's exactly what you want to use, 1/4 cup. You could probably get by with a very sharp cheddar cheese, but frankly, the feta cheese is dynamite. Not American cheese, and not Velveeta. Actually, I've got a stamp collection. I love stamping envelopes, and one of my stamps says, use Velveeta and die. That's one of my stamps. Use Velveeta and die. I used to love it as a kid, but I mean, it's, you know, plastic cheese. A tablespoonful of fresh mint, finely chopped.
A big tea. Fresh mint.
If you don't like mint, and my wife doesn't like mint,
really?
You don't have to use it. You can use parsley. And about a tablespoonful of olive oil.
Big tea olive oil.
Right. And once again, the lamb tends to be oily, so you don't have to use that if you don't want to. So
can I taste?
Very simple. Yes, you can taste.
Thank you.
Preheat the oven to 250 degrees. Then in a large bowl, combine the lamb meat, garlic, and salt. Gently toss it to blend. In a smaller bowl, combine the feta or any other goat cheese with mint, and then create 12 small balls of meat. Then make a small hole in each ball and stuff it with a teaspoon of the mint cheese filling. Right in the center. Press the patty down or with the remaining lamb. This, by the way, can be made a day ahead. Heat the olive oil in a large skillet over medium heat, or you could spray some Pam cooking spray, and cook the lamb patties until browned on both sides, roughly at about 3 minutes. Transfer the patties to a baking sheet and keep them warm. Very important. You do not want to eat this cold. Keep that warm until you're ready. And let me tell you something. The lamb patties look small, which is what they are, but the taste is so delicious that you can't eat too many of these. Well, some people can eat too many of these. But basically, one or two lamb patties are more than enough. Each lamb patty is 105 calories, hardly any calories at all. 6 grams of fat. It's a delicious, delicious patty. Try it. Stuffed lamb burgers, you will enjoy this dish. Yeah.
Well, you know how good this is, but you're going to cut yourself a piece?
I'm definitely going to cut myself a piece. As you go on, I'm going to cut myself a piece.
I'm just going to say, we're happy to make this recipe available to you on the web, Zorba, at
www.zorbapastor.org. You can get that recipe. You can also look at a bunch of other fine recipes in our archive, and you can sign up for our podcast.
Our phone number.
Boy, was that delicious.
Wasn't it good? 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, and a listener with us in Richland Center, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. How can we help you?
Well, my question's regarding heavy metal in tuna. I've been changing my eating habits by choosing to eat more lean meats, vegetables, and whole grains.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband is concerned with the amount of tuna I eat due to reports of the mercury or other metals in the fish. And I typically have about a 3-ounce portion of tuna a day. And I'd like to know, what are the long-term effects of eating tuna?
Yeah, I wonder about that, too. My wife has cut way back and probably never eats tuna anymore, for I think the same reason.
Well, there are a couple of interesting things. First of all, mercury is around us, and we want to reduce the amount of mercury, you know, that we take in. If we look at years ago, it was just, I mean, when I was a kid, we got mercury in elementary school, and we would play with it. And do you remember doing that? Did you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You put it in your hand and watch it roll around.
And watch it roll around, and you'd put it on a quarter and make it all shiny and stuff like that. There was always mercury around. Who
in
knew?
Science class, you did.
In science class. Who knew that science class would be toxic? I mean, who would have expected that? I mean, I can remember the taste also when I was a kid of lead soldiers. Who knew? The issue, though, has to do with children. We know that mercury is a big issue in children and in the growing brain. Now, for adults, we don't really know. The question has been posed by the USDA and the FDA of how much tuna is an okay amount of tuna to eat, because this question comes up all the time. And generally, the overall answer, and they haven't really chimed in completely, is that having tuna 2 to 3 days a week is probably safe. Having tuna every single day, probably something I wouldn't do. And once again, the reason is just, you know, put some variety into your body. Let your body, if there is something that's, quote, toxic, which I think is, you know, tuna is an extremely common foodstuff. If there was lots of mercury in tuna, we ought to see a lot of mercury poisoning, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most common fish that's consumed in America is tuna. And if that's the case, then why don't I see mercury poisoning in my practice, in the hospital? We don't see it.
Well, let me ask this. Couldn't I be getting a little bit sick, but not sick enough to go to the doctor
But you'd expect that some people would start to have severe illnesses. I mean, and mercury, I have never, ever, in my whole lifetime as a career as a physician, seen or heard of anyone being in the hospital in my area for mercury poisoning. I mean, if it were a common problem, we ought to see it. And we ought to see severe episodes of it. So I think, frankly, there's a whole – you know something? There are fearmongers out there who want us to be afraid of everything. And the fact is, I think the fearmongers, you know, connect to something such as tuna, because there are a number of things involved with the catching of tuna, such as the catching of dolphins, that turn out to be politically sensitive. And I think sometimes those are things that outweigh the science behind it. Given that, I wouldn't eat anything every day. I don't care what it is. I just would not eat the same thing every day. I think you need to have a variety of foodstuffs every day and give your body
juice
a chance to change.
You can have orange juice.
Well, for you, it's Carnation Instant Breakfast every morning, and I wouldn't eat that any day. Any day it wouldn't be something that would be something that I would eat. So.
Anyway, back to our listener. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413.
You know, those instant drinks, one of these days we're going to find out there's something they put in there that's toxic. Who knows?
Vitamins.
Vitamins. That's right, in large amounts. There we go.
Let's see if we can help a listener in Boise, Idaho now. Hi.
Hi, guys.
How can we help?
I have a newly developed problem with my eyes. Mm-hmm. My eyes and eyelids have suddenly become very red, and particularly my eyelids. So I was hoping you could provide some advice.
Yeah. How long has this been going on?
About a month or two.
Is there a discharge in there? Or are your eyes stuck shut in the morning when you get up?
Not at all.
Do they itch?
No.
Okay, they don't itch. Uh-huh.
Do you wear contacts?
No, and I don't touch my eyes unless I'm, you know, putting on eye makeup or something like that.
And, well, that was my next question. What sort of mascara? Have you changed mascara at all?
No, I haven't. That's what's so odd about this whole situation. I haven't changed anything at all. One day I just woke up and I noticed that they were very, very red, the eyes. Mm-hmm. And then a few days later, the eyelids.
Uh-huh.
And so I went to the eye doctor, obviously, and I received some eye drops, and mm-hmm. those seem to work. And then when they run out, of course, then I'm back to the red eyes.
Uh-huh. Do you put on eye makeup every day?
Not on the weekends.
Wait a second. You put it on during the week, but not on the weekends?
Because I have to go to work.
Because you have to go to work, I see. Your eyes? So your eyes have to be good at work, but when you're on the weekend with your friends, you can be whatever you want to be.
Basically,
yeah. Oh, life is so interesting, isn't it? Just with that. Well, getting back to this, one of the things that you can develop some inflammation and some allergy, and it may actually, even though the eye makeup hasn't been changed at all, my recommendation is you know you're going to wear it during the week. I would wash your eyes with Johnson's baby shampoo, very dilute solution. Put a few drops in some water. When you get home, take off your makeup, wash it with a clean cotton ball. Do not use the same cloth each and every time, and clean it completely off of your eyes. And that might do it. It might be that the makeup, for whatever reason now, is clogging your pores and causing a little bit of an inflammatory response. I would get it under control by refilling the eye drops, and you can call up your doctor or the nurse and say, I need refills of the eye drops. Get it under control and wash your eyes. And you got to wash it with – I recommend Johnson's Baby No More Tears because it doesn't hurt when you wash it. And you really want to clean your eye with the makeup all the time. You may also now have to change makeup. Sometimes you become hypersensitive or allergic, and you may have to go to another brand, Clinique, or another hypoallergenic makeup. And your cosmetologist – your local cosmetologist will help you. Now, I say that because my mother called herself – she was a cosmetologist at a department store in Chicago called Weebolts. And she was very proud of the fact that women would come with these makeup problems and she would solve them. So I've got that other credential of being the son of a cosmetologist besides a doctor. But whenever I talk about cosmetics, I always think of my mom, and that makes me feel good. So.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And good luck with your makeup at work.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot for the call. Time now, Zorba, for a tip. This advice comes to us from one of our listeners named Arlene.
Arlene, okay.
You'll remember a few weeks back we had a caller who was receiving static shocks every time she got out of her car.
Yes, I do.
Well,
yes,
Arlene has a home remedy for our caller.
Okay.
She writes, I have the same problem, and the solution is to carry a dryer sheet in your pocket. The dryer sheet will neutralize any static shock you may encounter. This is really handy when you have to go out, especially into supermarkets where the static is awful. Just ask the cashiers. Hope this helps.
A dryer sheet.
A dryer sheet in your pocket.
So she puts a dryer sheet in your pocket. So, I mean, it just sits in the pocket and just takes the static electricity.
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, that's very interesting. But dryer sheets do take away static electricity in dryers where your clothes are always clingy together.
Must take them away in your person as well.
Oh, isn't that fascinating? Wow, that's fascinating. You know what? We need more Arlenes in the world to discover remedies for which we have no solution. Thank you, Arlene.
Thanks, Arlene. Have a home remedy you want to share? Well, we want to hear it. Send your tips to us in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up. Some really interesting research. Oh, and our medical myth buster as well here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Glad to have you along. We'll be getting back to the phones. But first, some interesting research, I think, Zorba, on friends and the benefits of friends as far as longevity is concerned.
Absolutely. Very interesting. You know, a couple of years ago, I wrote a book, How to Live a Long, Sweet Life,
yes.
The Longevity Code. And one of the things I discovered in my research was that there are five spheres that influence you, physical and mental, family and social, spiritual and material. But it was the family and social sphere that was crucially important for people in terms of the life choices that they make. And this was an article that really fits right in with the research that I did years ago, and they looked at friendships in Australia. Now, as you can imagine, Australia is sort of a friendly society, and friendship is a very important thing in Australia. Yep. Most societies, friendships really count. In Australia, we know it's strong. They looked at Australian men and women who had a large circle of friends. Now, they don't look at relatives at all. They looked at people who have a large circle of friends. And they followed them over 10 years. They were looking at other things. It was a traditional longevity study. And lo and behold, people who had strong social relationships, lots of friends, were 22%, one-fifth less likely to die of a heart attack over a 10-year period versus people who only had one or two friends. And and I find that just fascinating. And it goes along with other studies that show that friends really count.
Friendship, at least according to these studies, is more important than being married.
Than being married. That's very interesting. Yeah, being married. Well, sometimes you're married to somebody and you're not necessarily their friend. But yeah, friendship appeared to be more important. But the marriage effect is still there. Marriage turns out to be extremely important for longevity, too, because people are much more likely to go to the doctors, seek help, and do things for somebody else. But friendship appears to be even stronger than marriage.
I looked through this article. They had this other study where they had backpacks and they had people going up the hill with backpacks.
Yes.
And the people who were with friends walking up the hill thought the backpacks were lighter than the people who were alone walking up the hill.
Fascinating. They basically put them next to a friend or put them next to somebody who they didn't know, and they were next to the friend and they were hiking up the hill. They were less likely to consider the weight to be something that was heavy.
Yeah. You know
and
what?
Maybe that's a very important issue.
Yeah. I wish I had friends.
You wish you had, well, of course you have friends. Gee, of course you have friends.
I'd
love strong social relationships. You definitely have friends. You've got a large circle of friends. I'm one of your friends. I'm one of the people. If I weren't here every single week, don't you think this would be a harder show? Absolutely. That's what friends
what
are
you
for.
Think,
I make
think,
the show
Tom?
Easier for you.
What's the medical answer
That's
to that
right.
question, Tom?
It would be much tougher. You see, we all have to have friends. Even you have to have friends, because otherwise the show would be harder. But seriously, folks, friendship is important for longevity and for sweetness.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller is in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
Well, my son, who is now 15 months, had ear tubes in November, and the surgery went well, but then we got an infection again. And I went back to my pediatrician two times for different rounds of antibiotics, and then at that point he said, go see the surgeon. And they took a culture, because he actually had basically snot running out of his ear. I mean, he just had like a runny ear instead of a runny nose.
Ooh.
So my question is, I wondered, why don't they do that more often? Because it seems like parents are always blamed for antibiotics not working. But if they did these cultures, then could we know what antibiotic to use, and then would those antibiotics work better?
Well, first of all, parents are always blamed by doctors, because parents are the easy scapegoat to be blamed. You know,
exactly.
By doctors. Why don't you bring your son in and daughter in earlier? Why'd you wait so long? Why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? I mean, sometimes it's really just junk. You know, it's not real honest to goodness stuff. Years ago, by the way, before we had good antibiotics, the treatment was, I can still remember, I worked with old Dr. Kellogg, and he had this very, very long spear. That's the best way for me to describe it. And he basically would look down at the ear with kind of a little scope, and he would puncture the eardrum to get the pus to come out, and they would be pain-free. And in fact, that's what the tubes are. It's under a surgical technique. The eardrum is punctured, and then there can be pus in the canal. But you've just discovered something else. A lot of times, the pus doesn't grow anything out. And in fact, in Europe, they don't use antibiotics for ear infections. They don't use it. 85% of the time, they do not use an antibiotic. And what they've discovered is this. Kids with ear infections tend to get better almost as quickly with antibiotics and without, but they cry 24 hours less. Mm. Now, that's an important point when it's your 24 hours and you're with your child, but the resolution rate of the infections is relatively unchanged.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
It is.
I mean, I find that fascinating because we put in tubes, and tubes are the most common procedure done, surgical procedure done in America today. And in Europe, they're very uncommon. In Holland, they never do them. In France, they hardly ever do them. In England, they rarely do them. And in America, we always do them. And there's no increase in deafness among the Europeans versus us. So what does this mean? It means that your son had tubes and your son continues to have ear infections, not unusual, and basically your son will continue to have ear infections until he outgrows them.
Well, if, now they say that if this continues, they want to replace the tube. Should I just say forget it?
Well, why would they want to replace the tube? I'd get a second opinion. I mean, the tube is working.
Right.
Why do they want to replace the tube when the tube is working? Now, there are ENT docs who will probably call me up now, as they often do, and say, wait a minute, there's tube A versus tube B, and that's the difference between the tubes. But the reality is you Google NIH Consensus Committee on Otitis Media, and that'll give you the bottom line and the skinny of what the National Institute of Health thinks about the tubes. And a lot of them are put in when they don't need to.
Okay.
And that's why a lot of ENT surgeons, they just put them in because that's their training.
Yeah, I always Google
training.
That. What was that?
NIH Consensus Committee. Tom has just learned what Google means.
No, I know what Google means. What was that, the NIH?
Consensus Committee.
You said that's on it. Something else?
On otitis media, on ear infections.
I feel a little duped now.
Well, you're not duped. You're following standard medical care. You're not not really being duped at all. And your physician, it was a good physician, and they're only doing what their training tells them to do.
Right.
But the reality is they're trained to believe that tubes make a difference.
Okay.
And the reality is in Europe, they don't believe that. And there are some controversies between these two continents, North America and Europe, on certain things. And otitis is one of them. The other thing happens to be prostate cancer. But you don't have to worry about that until you're dead and your son is old.
Yes, that's true.
Good luck.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. 800-462-7413. Zorba, time now for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth this time about tattoos from Vanessa in St. Louis, Missouri. She writes, my aunt, the RN, used to tell us that if you have a tattoo, a doctor will never give you an MRI. Something about metal in the pigment burning you during the MRI process. Now, I know a lot of people with tattoos. I have one myself, and no one has ever mentioned this being a problem. I'm sure tats back in the day used to be made out of all kinds of stuff, so maybe it's true for folks with older tattoos or who got them from less than reputable tattooists.
You mean there are less than reputable tattooists around in the world? I couldn't imagine that.
I guess the question is, if I ever need an MRI at some point, am I going to be able to get one, or was our aunt just trying to scare us?
I think your aunt was just trying to scare you from getting a tattoo. There is no evidence that the metal, if there is metal, and there for the most part is not metal in the ink of tattoos, causes any problem at all. But the thing about tattoos, of course, that's most interesting, and there are some people who are less than reputable, especially if you decide to get a tattoo at a rock concert, are the other things that can be spread.
Speaking from experience.
Right. No, I do not have a tattoo, Tom. I do not have a tattoo on my body anywhere.
Yes.
But they do. The real issue is the safety of the tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
The safety is whether or not the needle is sterilized because tattoos and doing tattooing is a great way to spread syphilis. In fact, that was a common reason years ago when I was in medical school. If somebody had a tattoo, you always check them for syphilis because syphilis is spread that way. HIV AIDS is spread that way. Hepatitis A, B, and C are spread that way. So you've got to make sure the tattoo is done by somebody who is certified, registered. These are under local authorities. The FDA does not regulate the inks. So a lot of the inks are made with a whole bunch of stuff. They're printer inks and other things that have never been regulated. So if you're going to get a tattoo, get it by somebody who is licensed by your state or certified by your state. You make sure that they open it up, that the needles have really been sterilized. And don't worry about the MRI scan. That is not a reason not to get a tattoo. Get your tattoo and enjoy it.
There are a lot of tattoos these days. If it were true that you couldn't get an MRI if you had a tattoo, the MRI people would go out of business, I think.
Yeah, they would go out of business. There's so many tattoos, that's right, that the MRI machines would go out of business. So, you know, tattoo, by the way, was a Captain Cook. He's the one who brought tattooing from the Polynesian Islands back in the 1700s. It wasn't in Europe until then, so it's a Polynesian historical fact.
Mm-hmm. Credit or blame, however you like to
credit call it. Or blame.
Yeah. Tattoo won't disqualify your myth. If you want it busted, just send it to us in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Again, our phone number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi.
Hey, how you doing, Doc?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, my question is concerning vitamin supplements. I am a truck driver, and I was wondering if the supplements that I take, which are varied, but a multiple and some others, I was wondering if that would supplement a good diet. Mm-hmm. I really, doing what I do, I don't have time to stop and eat a full good meal, good solid meal three times a day. It's just no way I can do it and do what I do.
Yeah, I got it. Wait, can you tell us those other supplements besides multiple vitamins?
Well, I take I've just started taking a D3. I take a blue-green algae. I've been taking that for about 8 or 9 years. And I take a fish oil kind of type stuff, in omega-3 stuff.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, let me comment on a few things. First of all, multivitamin, I think it's a great idea. Anyone who doesn't eat well, and frankly, none of us eat perfectly except for the few with obsessive compulsive disorder who look at every single meal that they eat, and that's about 5% of the population. So multivitamin, cheap, inexpensive. I don't go with the name brand. I don't think it really matters, but I recommend the vitamin, say, multivitamin plus minerals, USP. And USP means U.S. Pharmacopoeia, and it meets certain standards of dissolution in your stomach. In other words, the vitamin comes out in your stomach the right way. That's important. I agree with D3, 1,000 to 2,000 international units. We don't get enough D3. Fish oil, 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams a day of fish oil will help reduce your cholesterol and triglycerides. So between 1,000 and 3,000 milligrams a day. The caps are generally 1,000. Blue-green algae, not a lot of evidence for that. So if I were going to drop something, and I don't think you have to, but if you're going to drop something, the blue-green algae has the least evidence of efficacy. So that's probably the thing I drop. Now, getting back to your problem as a trucker, it's important for you to have good, nutritious foods with you so you can get vitamins and minerals. So I recommend, you know, you have your little cooler or refrigerator in your rig, you know, some carrot sticks, some broccoli, some, you know, nice green things, some fruits that you pick up, a banana in there. You're not going to eat perfectly, but you want to make sure that your snack time is healthy. And nuts are good, not peanuts. But any kind of other nuts, you know, you grab a handful of nuts because they have omega-3 fatty acids, which are good for your heart and for your brain.
Right, like almonds and pecans, stuff like that?
Absolutely. Almonds, cashews, pecans. What I do is I happen to have I buy them in bulk, and I buy a bunch of bags of nuts, and then whatever I feel like eating, I have them at my desk, and I have them in a little box underneath there, and I might grab some pistachios one day, some almonds the next day, some walnuts the next day, because I like it, some cashews. I think a variety of nuts. Nuts are the seed of life. Good omega-3 fatty acids, and they keep you away from chips, which are the destroyer of life. You know, I mean, that's kind of the way I think of it.
I understand perfectly, and that's good news, man. I appreciate you, Doc.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your call.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. And before a listener calls or emails, there really is no such thing as blue gene allergy.
blue green. Blue green. Did I say blue gene algae?
Blue gene algae, yeah.
You know, sometimes my brain just gets behind or ahead of my mouth. It's blue green algae. I stand corrected. You know, the grammar police would be out there as we speak. They are texting away or twitting away the blue green algae.
Before we get out of here, Zorba, let's go to the Zorba Pastor in Your Health inbox and see if we can help out Shelley, who has a very unusual stump the doc question for you. It seems that Shelley and her husband have stumbled onto a rather bizarre cure for athlete's foot and would like your take. Shelley writes, "My husband suffered for years, and then one of our Portuguese water dogs started licking his toes. At bedtime, she would stare at his feet under the covers until he let her clean between his toes. It cleared up and has not returned." That's the athlete's foot. "It's also a wonderful foot massage. What is the miracle of dog saliva?"
You know, there's a phrase, don't look a gift horse in the mouth, and I think it applies to dogs also, and that's about where I'm going to leave it at. I have not the foggiest idea what's working, but you know, if making your life sweet means a dog is licking in between your toes, I say go for it. No harm, no foul, enjoy.
And if it cleans up the athlete's foot, maybe that's why President Obama picked that breed. He does play a lot of basketball, you know.
We'll just have to send him a Twitter message and see what he has to say.
If you think you can stump public radio's favorite family doc or just want to gross out our staff, send your questions in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, we'll see you next week.
A pleasure, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, our producer is available anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg, the Lennon and McCartney of radio production, are on the other side of the glass. Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, letting you know that both Brad and Adam are alive and hoping that you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0502Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.